Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on the latest in managing fluid overload in patients with chronic kidney disease, or CKD. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online activity, Dr. Sunil Udani highlights treatment guidelines and the various therapies for managing CKD and CKD-associated fluid overload. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from SC Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Dr. Udani begins with a brief overview of the burden of CKD.
Let's start with a discussion briefly on the problem of chronic kidney disease as a whole from an epidemiologic standpoint. First off, definitions. The Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes Organization, or KDIGO, defines CKD as an estimated GFR of less than 60 mL per minute per 1.73 meters squared and or markers of kidney damage for greater than 3 months. What we know is that the prevalence of chronic kidney disease in the U.S. is quite striking. Nearly 14% of adults, or 35.5 million people, are affected. And this is not isolated to the United States. This is a global problem, with a global CKD prevalence is somewhere in the range of 9.1 to 13% of the world's population. Certainly a large problem, and with our increasing age, increasing comorbidities, this is something that we are increasingly facing.
Dr. Udani then moves on to discuss fluid overload as a complication of CKD and how excess fluid can lead to worsening kidney function in a vicious cycle.
One of the major complications of chronic kidney disease that as a clinician we face every day is fluid overload. If you look at patients with non-dialysis chronic kidney disease, nearly half of them have some degree of fluid overload. And fluid overload plays a vicious cycle in the progression of chronic kidney disease, where increased volume overload exacerbates chronic kidney disease itself, worsening kidney function, makes a scenario where it's more difficult to excrete sodium and water, which leads to more fluid overload and increases diuretic resistance. And then once again, that worsening fluid overload exacerbates elevated blood pressure and again worsens chronic kidney disease. So this really is a vicious cycle that can progress. And not only are we concerned about the progression of chronic kidney disease, we're also concerned about the cardiovascular complications, because unfortunately, our patients with chronic kidney disease are much more likely to die of cardiovascular disease than even if they are to progress with their chronic kidney disease. There is a dynamic interplay between volume excess and kidney disease, and we see this most strikingly in studies of congestive heart failure. For many years, the prevailing thought was that the problem with kidney function in the setting of congestive heart failure was a problem of what we refer to as quote-unquote forward flow, where a diseased heart was not allowed to provide enough perfusion pressure to the kidney to function. But data from the ESCAPE trial, which was done over 15 years ago now, provided us insight that really changed the way we think about this. Rather than cardiac output or cardiac index or even systolic blood pressure, it was congestion that was determined to be the biggest predictor of worsening kidney function and congestive heart failure, specifically looking at right atrial pressure. So the greater the right atrial pressure, the more likely an individual would present with worsening kidney function. And that seemed to hold true for different phenotypes of heart failure as well. Not only our conventional systolic heart failure, but heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, as well as those with pulmonary hypertension. Exactly how fluid overload leads to worsening kidney function is not entirely clear, but we really think it's two prevailing mechanisms that drive this. One is the idea of renal venous congestion, very akin to congestive hepatopathy, and the other is the concept of increased intra-abdominal pressure. Let's talk about the first one, renal venous congestion. If you track back the fluid overload or pressure overload that occurs in heart failure, you have a right atrium that's dilated and overfilled. That transmits back to an inferior vena cava that's dilated and overfilled. Ultimately, that transmits back to the renal venous system and ultimately back to the efferent arteriole. Efferent arteriole, the pressure is then increased, and this leads to a scenario where there is increased resistance to filtration. Again, creating a scenario that looks like renal hypoperfusion, but rather than an issue of perfusion, it's an issue of back pressure buildup. The other thought that may occur in patients with heart failure and worsening kidney function is increased intra-abdominal pressure. We know that individuals with congestive heart failure oftentimes present with splanchnic congestion and abdominal distension. And an extreme version of this is when intra-abdominal pressure actually increases. And given the renal perfusion is dependent not only on mean arterial pressure, but the difference between mean arterial pressure and intra-abdominal pressure, if intra-abdominal pressure is increased, abdominal perfusion pressure and renal perfusion pressure goes down. So this can be another mechanism by which volume excess in the setting of heart failure or other diseases that cause volume excess can lead to worsening kidney function.
Next, Dr. Udani reviews key details from the Kidney Disease, Improving Global Outcomes, or KDIGO, guidelines for managing CKD and controlling fluid overload with an overview of the classes of medications that may be used.
In 2024, KDIGO updated their guidelines for the treatment of chronic kidney disease. And ultimately, we know we have to take a multifaceted approach. The key takeaways from the guidelines are a few things. You know, one is the idea that patients with chronic kidney disease are not only at risk for CKD progression, but are at risk for cardiovascular disease. And so when we think about treating our patients with chronic kidney disease, we really want to think about the whole spectrum of their health. We want to, of course, think about lifestyle interventions, healthy diet, physical activity, tobacco cessation, and weight management. But thankfully, we have a greater armamentarium of medication therapies that we know can help with preventing CKD progression. First-line drug therapy includes RAS inhibition to target blood pressure less than 120 millimeters of mercury. SGLT2 inhibitors have emerged as another first-line therapy for most patients with chronic kidney disease and to continue along until a patient ends up on dialysis or transplantation. But again, identifying that these individuals are at high risk for cardiovascular disease, we also should consider their underlying CAD risk or cerebral vascular disease risk and institute high-intensity statin therapy. In addition to those first-line therapies, there are more specific therapies depending on the patients and depending on whether their hypertension prevails or they have diabetes. There are specific therapies that we know we can help with not only managing blood pressure, cardiovascular risk, but preventing CKD progression. Well, let me start with the basics. And you know, RAS inhibition has become the foundation of CKD preventative therapy for the last over 20 years. And what we know now is that RAS inhibition works in multiple ways to provide renal protection. The most apparent way is at the hemodynamic level, where the reduction or blockade of angiotensin II reduces intraglomerular pressure. And by doing so, this leads to blunting of hyperfiltration, reduces protein loss, and ultimately also creates a scenario where there is a lower oncotic and osmotic pressure in the peritubular capillaries that leads to a lower drive for sodium and water retention. So in the individuals that can tolerate RAS inhibition, those who do not have angiotensin II dependent blood flow, this remains the mainstay of therapy for renal protection and cardiovascular protection. In terms of managing fluid overload, ultimately, we know that there are a variety of diuretic therapies that can be effective. And ultimately, understanding physiologically where they work can help us rationally select which diuretic therapy should be used at which period of time. Let's start with the thiazide diuretics or thiazide-like diuretics. The thiazide diuretics have become a mainstay of hypertension control since the JNC guidelines for over a decade. There are, however, important differences between various thiazide-type diuretics in terms of their peak of onset, their half-life, and duration of action. The one thiazide diuretic that's most commonly used is hydrochlorothiazide. And while effective as a blood pressure-lowering therapy, we know there are certain limitations. Specifically, the duration of action tends to be shorter, 6 to 12 hours, than some of the other thiazide diuretics. Its bioavailability is also limited, and its peak effect is shortened. And so its effectiveness, especially in those people with chronic kidney disease or impaired bioavailability, may be diminished. Alternatives include chlorthalidone and indapamide, as well as metolazone, and they have also different characteristics. Chlorthalidone and metolazone, while their bioavailability is limited, they have their own positive effects, and specifically in patients with chronic kidney disease. They can be used with lower eGFRs. Chlorthalidone has a very long half-life, so once daily dosing is very effective. Metolazone, on the other hand, the half-life is similar to hydrochlorothiazide, but because it can be used at very low GFRs, its utility in managing fluid overload in patients with advanced chronic kidney disease remains an essential tool. Lastly, indapamide remains the other thiazide-type diuretic that is used most commonly. Again, bioavailability of indapamide is quite good. The duration of action is quite good. And so oftentimes, this has become really the first-line therapy for thiazide-type diuretics in managing hypertension in patients with chronic kidney disease. Thiazides are not necessarily thought of as first-line treatment for fluid overload, but we know that they have effects on blood pressure, which we know is partially, at least, fluid-mediated. There's been a series of studies, most recently in 2021, that demonstrated even individuals more with more advanced CKD, blood pressure can effectively be dropped with thiazide diuretics, specifically with chlorothalidone. And so they remain a powerful and important tool in our management of chronic kidney disease-associated hypertension and fluid retention. Ultimately, loop diuretics really remain the cornerstone in treatment of fluid overload. They, of course, have oral and IV administration. However, again, there are important differences between the agents, furosemide, bumetanide, torsemide, and ethocrinic acid, specifically with regard to bioavailability and duration of action. To go into that in more detail, furosemide, while most commonly used, is quite limited in many ways, specifically in its bioavailability. The oral bioavailability of furosemide is somewhere in the range of 45 to 65%. Probably gets to be even lower when patients have more intestinal edema. And then the half-life is quite limited, especially in patients with chronic kidney disease. It can be, you know, limited to, you know, 4 to 6 hours. Bumetanide shares a similar short half-life, but the bioavailability is much better, as well as its effect in patients with more protein-losing states. So the oral and IV doses of bumetanide are nearly equivalent. Now, of course, as patients get more fluid retention, this can also be limited. But for the most patients, we can treat these as fairly equivalent. Lastly, the other loop diuretic that's most commonly used is torsemide. And the advantage of torsemide is it's much longer half-life and it's high bioavailability. Now, there's been some recent question on exactly the bioavailability of oral torsemide, especially in patients with chronic kidney disease and heart failure. Well, we previously thought it was, you know, near 100%. This may be more limited than we thought. And therefore, really looking at patient responses becomes key in terms of selecting specific loop diuretics and frequency of dosing. Ethocrinic acid is really limited to those patients with severe self-allergies. So something we're not using very often, but still is important to recognize. It is highly bioavailable and has a duration of action similar to bumetanide and furosemide. The difficulty is in its availability and its high cost. More recently, sodium glucose transport 2 inhibitors, or SGLT2 inhibitors, have emerged as a valuable tool in chronic kidney disease treatment. And really, their effectiveness is quite broad in terms of different mechanisms of kidney and heart disease protection. Firstly, they act as a natriuretic agent in that they block sodium and glucose reabsorption in the proximal tubule. But in difference to conventional diuretics, because of their site of action in the proximal tubule and the increased chloride delivery to the macula densa, this leads to actually a suppression of renin release and ultimately a suppression of renin, angiotensin, and aldosterone. So really downregulating the neurohormonal pathway that leads to fluid retention and cardiovascular disease and CKD progression overall. And therefore, they really become a mainstay, a foundational treatment in management of chronic kidney disease and fluid overload. SGLT2 inhibitors really became established as standard of care based on multiple studies that demonstrated both cardiovascular and CKD progression positive outcomes. The CREDENCE trial led to this with the demonstration of renal protection in patients with diabetic nephropathy, but this has evolved to a non-diabetic population based on the DAPA-CKD study as well as the EMPA-Kidney study. And again, not only are they effective for preventing CKD progression, but they've been demonstrated in multiple studies, DAPA-HF, EMPA-Reduce, EMPA-Preserve, DELIVER, where they provide cardiovascular protection and specifically protection for patients with congestive heart failure with both reduced and preserved ejection fraction. regardless of which population you look at, those with diabetes, those without diabetes, even those with lower eGFRs in the progressive studies, the consistent data is that SGLT2 inhibitors are protective. And is this consistent data that has led to them once again becoming first-line therapy and standard of care for patients with chronic kidney disease at risk for progression or chronic kidney disease with fluid retention. The last therapy class that is demonstrated to be protective is the mineralocorticoids. And we've known these to be cardioprotective for many years, but also we've recognized that aldosterone plays a deleterious role in renal dysfunction, as well as sodium and water retention. And so MRAs have become another class of therapy that is identified as a tool in CKD and heart disease. Once again, multiple studies have looked at this in various populations. Initially, these were of conventional MRAs, spironolactone and eplerenone. More recently, in the non-steroidal MRAs, E6-hexaranone as well as finerenone, and looking at specifically reduction of UACR and kidney disease protection.
Dr. Udani then examines diuretic resistance and novel strategies for overcoming resistance.
Diuretic resistance, and this is defined as the attenuation of the maximal diuretic effect that ultimately limits sodium and chloride excretion. And we know that diuretic resistance is what we face, especially faced with patients with renal impairment. And once you have developed diuretic resistance, your risk of rehospitalization, worsening heart failure, mortality, and also worsening kidney function all increases. You know, the prevalence of diuretic resistance is variable, and I'd say it's likely increasing, but it's estimated in the 20 to 30% range. And again, the risk factors of diuretic resistance are all the things we would expect in patients with congestive heart failure, renal dysfunction, elevated serum creatinine, especially those with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction or advanced heart failure who have lower systolic blood pressure, those that have been chronically on diuretic therapy and have lower serum chloride, as well as older age, and female sex, which is unclear in why, but may reflect some variability in absorption or pharmacokinetics. The kidney, of course, plays a central role in diuretic resistance because there's really functional and structural adaptive changes in the kidney that occur, ultimately that result in upregulation of processes that are involved in renal sodium absorption. You know, the kidney essentially develops compensatory responses to try to consistently blunt the natriuretic effect, as well as the fact that, you know, CKD reduces the excretion of diuretics into the tubular lumen, so their site of activity is not as effective. So really, all these things can play a role. We know that the things that we face probably most commonly are renal and intestinal congestion, especially in our patients with right heart failure manifestations, chronic kidneys, as I mentioned, low serum albumin, which can occur due to concomitant renal disease and protein-losing nephropathies, as well as those that have been chronically ill. Naturally, chronic use of loop diuretics leads to these compensatory responses. So all these things ultimately play a role in developing diuretic resistance. You know, diving into more detail, we sort of tackle or provide an overview of diuretic resistance from a physiologic standpoint, looking at each step in the process of diuretics becoming active. You know, first is the idea of diuretics becoming bioavailable. And in patients, specifically patients with heart failure that have, you know, splanchnic congestion and intestinal edema, we know this significantly blunts the bioavailability. And we thought this was limited to furosemide, but we're seeing now that that may include torsemide as well. Then as a result of decreased bioavailability and decreased renal blood flow, you're going to have decreased drug delivery. And that can be also related to if patients are losing significant amounts of protein and furosemide being protein bound, then it's lost in the urine and can't get into the site of activity. We know, again, in the congested kidney, there's impaired sodium delivery. And so ultimately for loop diuretics to be effective, there must be sodium delivery to the site of the loop. And so if there is venous congestion or poor cardiac output that leads to reduction in sodium delivery, that is blunted. And the two other things that are seen, especially in patients that have been on diuretics consistently, is the phenomenon of braking, where intermittent diuretic dosing leads to these periods of time where the kidney is diuretic free in terms of the concentration and the sodium and water reabsorption is maximized. And then lastly, in the fact that the those are on chronic loop diuretic therapy, the distal nephron, which usually does not have the resorptive capacity to really retain much salt and water, increases. And in that case, then sequential diuretic therapy can be effective, but that has its own limitations. So how do we overcome diuretic resistance? Well, naturally, we want to do the basics, which is make sure that diuretics are being administered and taken as prescribed, and that there's sodium restriction and perhaps even carbohydrate restriction. We talk about combined diuretic therapies, but there has been more novel approaches. One is using continuous administration of loop diuretics, which we'll go into more detail in the next few minutes. We have in small case series, we have used the combination of hypertonic saline in addition to loop diuretics, which is quite counterintuitive, but has had a profound effect in some patients with diuretic resistance. But both of those still require essentially hospital or at least infusion center utilization. And now we are seeing the newer formulation of diuretics, such as subcutaneous and nasal forms, that can potentially bypass the challenges of bioavailability, but used at home. So, in terms of continuous infusion versus intermittent dosing, there's been a few studies that have been done. There's been some controversy regarding the whether it's really effective, but I think the key thing is that in patients with kidney disease, I think the effect is more. And this is one study out of India, looked at 42 patients, and they looked at intermittent versus continuous dosing, and they saw that continuous dosing allowed for greater sodium and water excretion. There's another study out of Asia that also looked at 81 patients with CKD and intermittent versus continuous dosing, and they saw similar effects where dyspnea scores, urine output, sodium excretion was also improved in the continuous infusion group. But as I said, this still requires hospitalization or at least a extended stay in an ambulatory infusion center. So we're looking for strategies to utilize therapies at home. And subcutaneous furosemide has become one of those strategies where we can administer this at home safely. And it essentially provides a bolus dose as well as a continuous infusion, but at home. And because it's given subcutaneously, the bioavailability is very comparable to IV formulations. And we've seen this. When they looked at this, plasma furosemide levels are similar in subcutaneous versus IV administration. And the effects are also similar in terms of using IV doses versus subcutaneous, both in diuresis and sodium excretion. Even in patients with chronic kidney disease, we see that the effect is still present, where there is an increase in urine output or similar to urine output in subcutaneous dosing compared to IV dosing. And then we've seen now clinical data to suggest its use. There's a few studies that have highlighted it. One was the at-home heart failure study, which was a phase II pilot study that looked at using furosemide subcutaneous versus usual care in patients with heart failure and fluid overload. And subcutaneous dosing could be dosed daily or twice daily at physician discretion. And they looked at the outcomes of looking at change in weight, improvement in 6-minute walk distance, dyspnea scores, congestion, and all those things improve in the subcutaneous furosemide arm. The majority of AEs were quite mild or moderate at worst, but were not such that the therapy had to be stopped. The Freedom Heart Failure study was similar in the sense of, again, trying to look at ways to reduce hospitalization. And individuals that presented to the emergency department, they were discharged, received subcutaneous furosemide for 7 days or less. And again, it was dosed daily or twice daily per physician discretion, versus the control group, which was treated with usual care and oftentimes required hospitalization, the cost of care was significantly lower. And as we are now in the value-based care era, and we have to be stewards of healthcare utilization, this becomes an appealing option. Now let's talk about a study that specifically looked at individuals with defined diuretic resistance. And this was based on a validated diuretic resistance score and looking at two outcomes. One is diuretic efficiency, which measures urine output per milligram of furosemide given, as well as peak urine sodium concentration at 4 hours, which we know is a surrogate marker of natriuresis or natriuretic efficiency. And in this study, they looked at both patients with diuretic resistance as well as those without. And what they saw is that subcutaneous furosemide was consistently more effective, meaning that it was more effective in those with diuretic resistance. It was similar in those without diuretic resistance, suggesting that, you know, you can still use oral furosemide. But again, both in urine sodium excretion as well as diuretic efficiency, subcutaneous furosemide and those with diuretic resistance had a specific advantage. There are other formulations that are being explored. One is a nasal spray formulation, PBAT9. So once again, trying to bypass the concerns about oral bioavailability. This uses a nasal spray and compared it to oral and IV bumetanide. And what they saw is that the diuretic concentrations of the nasal spray were equivalent to those seen in oral and IV formulations. This is, you know, quite early in its development, so we are still some time away from clinical use, but it is promising to see that development in this area is ongoing.
Finally, Dr. Udani demonstrates his approach to managing fluid overload using an example patient case.
Now, let's look at a case study so that we can more practically approach how we may manage one of these patients that can be quite difficult. So we have a 74-year-old gentleman, history of chronic kidney disease, stage 4, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, diabetes with diabetic nephropathy, who has persistent fluid overload. Because of how challenging his fluid overload had been, he actually had a implantable PA pressure monitor in place, and so that was helping us guide his targeted therapy. He was on background standard of care for HFpEF with the SGLT2 inhibitor as well as MRA, but he had escalating loop diuretic requirements. He was on bumetanide 2 milligrams twice daily, but intermittently required 4 milligrams twice daily based on PA pressure monitor readings. He would also receive intermittent IV diuretic dosing in clinic, 2 milligram IV push doses, 4 milligram bumetanide infusions. He was trialed on sequential diuretic therapy, adding metolazone, which is oftentimes a strategy in these situations. But this was quite, unfortunately, deleterious in him, as it was complicated by severe hypokalemia. He actually required hospitalization. So we looked, took a step back and said, okay, what else can we try to optimize? So we first of all converted his afterload reduction from hydralazine isosorbide to ARNI therapy. But even with that, he had persistently elevated filling pressures. He did respond to intravenous diuretics quite well, so we thought of the strategy of using subcutaneous furosemide, which provided quite a bit of improvement. We administered it twice weekly. There was minimal change in renal function, a serum creatinine 2.6, 3.0, 2.93, the eGFR trending from 25 to 22, and his filling pressures finally became on target. And he's not had ongoing requirements of additional IV or oral bumetanide doses. So naturally, you know, not every case is the same, but this provides you some insight in terms of how we may use all the tools at our disposal to try to achieve and maintain euvolemia. So to conclude, I would highlight that, you know, developing a treatment strategy for fluid overload with chronic kidney disease does require really an individualized approach, considering those patient-specific factors. Diuretic resistance is increasingly common, and it involves both patient factors as well as, you know, factors specific to the method of delivery of medications. And it ultimately limits the efficacy of our conventional diuretic strategies. So as our heart failure patients and patients with fluid overload are developing all those comorbidities that we've highlighted, you know, increased the likelihood of resistance, chronic kidney disease, low serum albumin, chronic diuretic use, we know that diuretic resistance is going to become more and more of an issue that we face. And we pair that with the idea that, the conventional means to overcome this has been, you know, really required hospitalization or at least extended stay in a, you know, an ambulatory healthcare environment, which again, in the current era of healthcare stewardship, is a much higher cost option. So utilizing therapies that can be used safely at home can not only overcome diuretic resistance, but keep people at home, which certainly is, you know, overall better for them and better for the healthcare system as a whole.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.